Good evening and welcome to My Stogie Mr. Goji with your host, Don Gonzalez and
Mark Connolly.
This is episode 22 of season 2. Our first segment is What Are You Smoking Now? And we'll be reviewing two different cigars that I don't think we've ever smoked before.
Yeah, I've never said this is the first time I even saw this one.
What's it called?
It is a Punch Gran Puro Nicaraguan.
Okay.
Which I guess the distinction there is most of the punches must be Dominican or something like that.
Alright, and I'm smoking an Arturo Fuente Don Carlos Robusto. And in our second segment, we're going to mix it up a little bit. We actually hinted a couple weeks ago or last week, I lose track, that we might venture back into the world of current events and pop culture, and because of the events of this past weekend, we're going to talk about racism, prejudice, stereotypes. We'll use the events from Saturday as kind of a launching point. My feeling is we're not going to spend our whole time talking about that. We're going to talk a little bit more generally about the topic. At least that's kind of my take on it. Mark might have a different view on that. So that's what we're going to do tonight. Thanks for joining us. If you've got one, smoke it while you're listening to us. Mark,
all right.
What are you smoking now?
So I've got a Punch Gran Puro Nicaraguan. So the Punch Gran Puro historically has been a Honduran Puro. So binder, wrapper, filler, all Honduran. So you might think that this was a Puro, since they're calling it a Puro, that it was full Nicaraguan, but it's not. It's a Nicaraguan filler and binder and a Connecticut broadleaf from the U.S. Wrapper. This one is a Maduro, and I do like the Maduros. Early on in my smoking experience, I almost smoked exclusively Maduros. So, I haven't smoked very many recently, just because of the cigar selection I've been picking up. This is about 5.5 inches long, a 54 ring gauge, and got it at the in the humidor over there on Josie and Trinity Mills. What's that across there? I never came.
Keller Springs.
That's right.
Are you sure that's a 54 ring gauge? I'm gonna say that's a 50 ring gauge.
Okay, I will bow to your superior eye. Actually, I had a ring gauge cheater somewhere around here, but I don't know where it went. Anyway. I just lit it right before we started recording. Like I said, I like the Maduros. A lot of people think that they're, just because they're dark, they're supposed to be harsher, stronger, whatever. But to me, they're actually a little bit milder, a little bit softer on the palate. I'm getting hints of smoke. So my traditional tastes like smoke. You know, so since I don't ever detect these flavors that everybody talks about, whether I like a cigar or not has to do with, is it burning hot? Do I have to fight it to keep it lit? So far, and I'm only like, I don't know, a little over a quarter of an inch in. So far, so good. We're once again pairing it with the Blender's Batch from Johnny Walker, 10-year-old. And this punch is supposed to be aged. And the guy at the shop was telling me he thought that some of the tobacco in here might be 10 years old. So,
very appropriate.
Anyway, I like it. And again, the Blender's Batch is a worthy scotch for me and my cigars.
All right. So I wanted to smoke another Fuente tonight, but I also wanted to smoke something different. And the shop I stopped at the Addison Cigar Shop. They took an old post office and converted that into a cigar shop.
Oh, really?
And the loading dock is an outside smoking area, and then they have an inside club members only area to smoke as well. It's a pretty large humidor that you, unlike some places, so you actually have to open the door and go, and they have a real humidor area.
Right.
It's not the whole store. I'm not throwing shade at anybody who can borrow friends from the kids. So I went in there with the intention of getting, like, see if they had an añejo or a work of art is the longer version of the short story. They didn't have any of that. So then I looked over and they had the Don Carlos. And Don Carlos was the Don Carlos Sr. And then there's Don Carlos Jr. Sr. who just recently passed away within the last year. But anyway, the preferred size for this particular smoke is the Robusto. So I hadn't seen one, and when I saw that they had a box full of them and it was moderately priced, I mean, it's probably on the higher end for more than $12 stick with tax. I thought, you know, I'll smoke a $12 stick. It is a Cameroon wrapper, like the Hemingway short story. Yes. That attracted me. And the filler and binder are premium proprietary Dominican, which is what they say about a lot of their blends. So I have no idea other than that. This is a medium to full-bodied cigar. It is rated as high as a 90 on Cigar Aficionado. And it draws very well right off the bat. It's smoking evenly. And initially, I'm picking up hints of kind of a woodiness. And I suspect, and I'll talk about this on the back end of the podcast, that I'm going to get the sweet, spicy aftertaste that you get from the short stories or whether they come from the Cameroon wrapper. So I'm looking forward to that because I always like that kind of sweet aftertaste when I smoke one of those short stories. And I, too, am smoking one of the Blenders batch Johnny Walker.
So I just have to read what this guy is saying on the internet, this one review I'm reading about this cigar, just so that I can say, okay. The aroma from the foot reminds me a bit of room temperature Coca-Cola with its sweet and syrupy offering, which gets followed by a bit of maraschino cherry and slight touches of pepper, smoke, and barnyard.
That can either mean hay or it can mean manure. I hope it means hay.
The cold draw is good as far as airflow, though each leans just a touch loose. It's drier and more wood forward than I was expecting, but there's a bit of buttermilk creaminess to be found, as well as varying amounts of pepper and spiciness on the lips. So yeah, I got none of that. That sounded like almost a joke to me.
Yeah, sometimes wood I feel forward. Like these people that write these reviews are just like, I gotta say something.
Yeah,
so.
Wood forward. It's like it's an amusing little wine, if a bit pretentious. You know.
No, I think that review's a little pretentious.
So,
I don't know. I think I have a pretty decent palate, but you know, I'm not sitting there trying to find something underneath another layer of of something, and I hear that, and I was like, how, I don't know, maybe there's some people like that, that are possible, that you know, pick up on that, you know.
Well, even if I detected a hint of maraschino cherry underneath this, I would never admit it.
You know, I don't ever recall ever picking up that type of flavor in a cigar. I have picked up a little bit of orange peel in kind of a spicy sort of cigar, and I want to say it was some Rocky Patel I smoked. It might have been the original Maduro Edge, but
wow.
Maraschino cherry, I think not. Talk about the band. That's an interesting band.
What really attracted me to it is it's got, I'm going to call it like a Caribbean band. It's green and light blue with dark blue lines. There's apparently a miniature image of some punch ancestor on it. It's a pretty band. So the punch, the word punch is in a red oval with a gold and kind of a white shield in the middle of it. But then it's got this, like I said, a light green and a light blue colored band.
Yeah, they're kind of pastel looking.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it makes me think Caribbean.
No, it's exactly what I thought when I saw it.
Yeah. So the swaying palm trees and the ocean and the maraschino cherries.
And speaking of bands, my band's a little bit different for a Fuente as well. Most of the Fuente cigar, well, the regular ones generally have gold with red trim, and the inside part will be have a hint of green as filler. And then they have their logo or their crest is really what it is.
Right.
And the Fuente, the Hemingways, I think, are almost entirely red and gold. And this Don Carlos is black. It has black hints throughout, and then the foreground of the shield is black.
Cool. So I'm about an inch in now, and there's no bite. It's very smooth. I don't know.
Picking up hints of coconut milk.
Wood forward barnyard. So, sorry.
That's all right. All right, so those cigars are smoking right now. We'll, at the tail end of the show, we'll come back and talk about any lasting thoughts we have about the cigar or any other comments we have about them as well. So, segment two.
Yes.
Racism in America. How will you solve it, Mark Conley? No, kidding. So, all joking aside, however you want to frame it, the events of this past weekend were ugly, and regardless of, I think it's fair to say objectively, regardless of who you blame for the events, I think worldwide America didn't come off looking very good that day.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I was one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it was because to me it was fascinating to watch my social media, particularly Facebook. I've talked before on the show that I can divide my friends into two camps. All my educator friends and friends with a quotation mark.
Right.
I mean Facebook friends, not Aristotelian Thomistic friends.
Right.
If you don't know what I mean, go back and listen to the podcast of episode
20 on friendship.
On friendship. Those tend to be my more liberal, progressive friends, and even a few of them are socialists and will come out and tell you this. And a couple of those people really are my friends. And then on the other side, I have more of my friends and family that I know through the Catholic Church. And they tend to be, not all of them, but most of them tend to be more conservative. And we've talked before on air about how there seems to be a lot of name-calling on social media. I'm not on Twitter very much, other than the stuff that we do for the podcast or for Joe Catholic. But both of those seem to be very mean-spirited, is the only thing. Like, and I'm being nice when I say that.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to me to see is that that for those friends of mine that I had that I consider devout Catholics, and then I have some friends on through Facebook that are, nationally recognized bloggers, speakers, and podcasters that in the Catholic realm. And I didn't hear much from them either. And that bothered me a little bit. From the standpoint of, at the very least, denounce the violence.
Right.
And then secondarily, I think that, at least from my standpoint, call things what they are. I think that you can come out and say, regardless of who started things or whatever, racism is bad. One of the last debate tournaments I judged was a national debate tournament that was hosted by the Greenhill School. They do this big round robin at the beginning of the year. And I judged a round by two of the top debaters in the country. And I was appalled that one of the kids made an argument that there was no objective standard by which we could evaluate that the Holocaust was evil.
Really?
Really. And these are supposed to be some of the brightest minds in our country. And that bothered me. I was like, really? Do you really mean that? You can't say that this is evil? That this is wrong? So, that was kind of my motivation. You know, I think that in some ways I've kind of steered away from asking you if you want to talk about some of the things that are going on in the world, because it just, I get so worn out from hearing it.
Yeah. Well, and first of all, what that guy said, that one of the top debaters, these are high school debate teams, yes. I guess. So one of the top high school debate team guys in the United States said there was no objective standard by which you could judge the Holocaust as evil. And unfortunately, I would say in the milieu in which he is being raised, he may be right. Because what do you base your standards on in a relativistic world? So while I completely disagree with him, I think I can see how somebody would come to that decision. And it comes from abandoning any idea of a moral high ground, because at some level, I would say even morality would be characterized as microaggression, depending on who it was applied to and when. And this whole idea, well, you can't put your standards on me and blah, blah, blah. So the problem with all that is there's nowhere to go with it. And when you were talking about Twitter and Facebook, you know, I've had both of them on my phone before. I've taken them off. I've put them on. They're currently off. I was on Twitter primarily just to kind of, it was sort of a, I felt like a snapshot of what was happening in the world. But it hit me the other day that what it actually was a high-tech version of grade school playground. Oh, yeah, you're stupid. Well, yeah, you're retarded. Uh-huh. Well, what about your sister? She's ugly. Oh, yeah? Well, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, that is actually the level of the quote-unquote debate that I see on Twitter.
And I would argue that that has spilled over into mainstream media as well.
Yeah. It's childish. It's almost contentless. It's frustrating. And so I just took it off my phone because I just didn't need that kind of... I mean, I already went through grade school, okay? I don't need to relive it. Just because it's Twitter and Facebook doesn't elevate it. It's not. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. It is grade school level thought and argumentation, which is to say it's neither. It's emotional and it's biased and it's ridiculous. And frankly, we should be ashamed that this is the quality of the conversation in the United States. Now, as far as the events that happened in Charlottesville, first, it's just, you know, horrendous tragedy that woman was killed. I can't even imagine what that would be like to be that person's mother or brother, sister, husband, whatever, to know that somebody just went someplace to exercise their right to, you know, their opinion and ended up dead because of a callous act of a stupid, ignorant fool. What's interesting to me about the outrage directed at President Trump is that we're oddly expecting the President of the United States to be our moral voice. Now, I want everybody to think about that for a minute. Why would he be our moral voice? Where is our own internal moral voice? Why do we have to go to an authority figure to get a moral voice on this? I don't need to wait for President Trump to say or do something to know whether something's right or wrong. I think that's absurd. Now, he completely failed in how he presented things. But what if he gave a really good speech? I mean, think about it. Let's say he gave a really good speech. What has been accomplished? What would that do? What would change because a figurehead who for much of this country is perceived as a buffoon and a cartoonish character, so he has a moment of clarity and says the right thing, doesn't fix the problem. So nobody's focusing on the problem. And I think that's one of the things you said in our pre-discussion. How do you fix this? And the reason there's so much frustration about this is because nobody knows how to fix it. And I think it's because the basics of what a society should be, a lot of people would be hard-pressed to present it in any coherent manner that was defensible.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that people aren't willing to really have discourse.
No.
You know, whether it's getting trapped into labels, we've talked about this on the show before too, you just pigeonhole somebody into a label and you must believe this and then I'm not going to listen to you, or your opinion has no value.
Right.
You know, because, you know, like, if one of the things I've seen recently, if you have voted for any of these people, you're a racist. No, you're not.
Yeah.
You know, just because, you know, that to me is crazy thinking. Because I would like to think that someone's choice for voting for someone is more complex than that.
You would hope. I mean, we're complex people. So... You know, I've heard a lot of things on the radio and read some things on Facebook, and the statement is simply made as if it is an undeniable fact that if you voted for Donald Trump, it is because you are a racist, which means that there's 48 million racists in this country.
And but that doesn't take us anywhere, because then I can turn around and say, well, because you voted for Hillary Clinton, you're a baby killer.
Right.
And you endorse killing babies.
Yeah, and that's not why people voted for either one of those people. I think it's much simpler than that as far as how Trump got elected, and it was essentially a backlash from people who didn't feel like they were being represented. And so they basically said, well, we're just going to burn this mother down and start over. And Trump looks like the right, you know, he's got fiery red hair, so let's get him, because we want to just... You know, we're tired and you gave us these crappy choices, so we're going to pick the one that we think is not entrenched in the status quo.
That's one of the things that I'm so tired of hearing. Well, first off, I think that one of my frustrations with Catholics in particular is that are quiet, is get over your Catholic first. And whatever political party you associate with secondarily, or maybe even tertiarily.
Yeah, I think it's a grotesque abuse to identify people by Republican or Democrat.
But I think that there are a significant group of people that have locked themselves into thinking that the Republican Party is the party of, since they label themselves pro-life or whatever, or they claim to align themselves with positions that are consistent with what the church teaches, that they're right on everything. And that's just not the case.
Now, let's be realistic. Those people are quote-unquote pro-life because they think that's their constituency that they can get voted by. And the minute that changes, I have zero faith that people who would lose an election based on being pro-life, if they felt... they had to moderate their stand, I think they would in a heartbeat, because their job is to get elected. Their job isn't to serve us. Their job is to get elected. In their minds, they're getting elected. So, and am I cynical? Yeah, I am very cynical. And why am I cynical? Look around. Why not? What can you point at that is an argument against cynicism against our current political process? I challenge anybody to point at anything that says, no, Mark, really, these are sincere people who have our best interests at heart. Okay, show me.
Mm-hmm. And where I was going with all of that is that, and I don't want to get too far down the road of talking about the election and all that, but both parties are to blame. I mean, like, I don't hear anybody saying this, all right? So I hear a lot of people say, well, y'all voted for Trump. You supported Trump. He's your problem. Y'all are the reason for that. Well, y'all put up a sorry candidate that lost to this guy.
Right.
You couldn't bring something better to the table?
Yeah.
Both parties were responsible for the mess that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what you get when you field crap candidates. And that's just the way it is. And why do we field crap candidates? Because we're lazy. We don't think. you know, the elections that matter are the local elections, because the local elections create tomorrow's national candidates. So we need to be doing a better job at the local level. I would submit that you could almost ignore the national election if you focused for the next 10 years on putting good people in office locally. Then you're going to have people who got into office for the right reasons and who over 10, 15, 20 years have that reinforced, and then they can take it national. But until that happens, we're going to continue to get Hillary and Trump. That's just how it is. So what's the issue there? You know, to me, this I think we could go back and revisit the whole Catholic Social Doctrine podcast and point out all the different ways that none of that's being applied currently in our society.
Right.
The dignity of the human person. Solidarity. Where's the solidarity? Okay. There's no solidarity. It's very much us against them. I was making the comment before we started that there are some people who would tell me that I've never experienced any kind of abuse or anything like that. I'm a white male. I'm 6'3". I'm 250 pounds. I'm what? The master race by some people's ideas. So how could I possibly have ever experienced any kind of discrimination? Well, in the first place, what do you mean by discrimination? Is discrimination just being mistreated? Okay. Or discrimination about a race thing? So let me ask this a little differently. I was bullied in grade school. I'm not homosexual and I'm not a minority. So how is it possible that I could have been bullied? In today's dialogue, the only people who get bullied are gay people or minorities. So how did I get bullied? Okay, I'll tell you how. I was the new kid in school. I was an outsider.
You're different.
Yes. Even though I went into a school of people who looked just like me, I wasn't part of that group that had come up through grade school. I was something new. And so I was bullied because of us against them. That's the parties in this country right now, us against them. And that us and them just morphs according to the need of the moment. And then our sorry media just they're not into news, they're into marketing, they've got a product to sell. And so they're not interested in integrity, they're interested in Nielsen points or whatever the current thing is. So they've completely failed us, and then people aren't having the dialogue amongst themselves. So how do we fix this? We need to look in the mirror to start with. And then we need to call things what they are because we can. The Holocaust was evil. We don't have to justify it. We don't have to support it. Everybody knows it. That poor kid who said there's no objective standard, bull. We know. Everybody knows. Nazis, bad. Racism, bad. All right? Call it what it is. And quit pretending. And quit making excuses. It's a really sad state of affairs when the primary focus right now is what Trump did and didn't do. Who's talking about solving this?
I don't hear anybody really talking about race relations.
No.
And it seems to me that race relations started to become more strained under the past administration. This isn't something that just happened now.
Mm-mm.
You used a term earlier on that I'm not sure people hear every day, and that term is microaggression.
Yeah.
I only learned this term a couple of years ago. And apparently microaggression is when someone, typically a white person, is talking to a woman or an ethnic minority and says something that isn't quite racist, but hints at it. They can't quite put their finger on it. For example, and this happened to me, this is a form of microaggression. Well, Don, where are you from?
Yes.
Now, if you don't know this from my surname, I'm Hispanic. of both Mexican and Spanish origin from both sides of the family. All right? So, I've heard that countless times. And in particular, I remember when I was in law school, it was my second year in law school, I was clerking for a firm in El Paso, which, by the way, for the first time in my life, I saw myself as part of the majority when I was in El Paso. It was right. The first time I'd ever seen so many professional Hispanics. It was really interesting to me. That's a different story for a different day. But I had a, he's now a friend, I've talked about him on the podcast, who I met there. And he's from Fort Worth. He went to law school at the University of Houston, and we clerked together in El Paso. He's Anglo. Anglo, white, European-American. What do we call you?
Yeah.
Are you sensitive about that, Mark?
No. No, but that, I mean, I see what you're saying, because the theory behind this microaggression, if I understand it, is no one would ask me where I'm from.
Right, right. There's a little bit, I mean, there's a hint of truth to that, don't get me wrong, okay? You know, the example I use with my students is no one's ever... If you didn't know that Dirk Nowitzki was German, you just saw him walking down the street, he's American, because he's white.
Right.
Or, and I would even argue for black people, okay? They don't get asked that question, at least not in this state, in right. Texas. But if you're Hispanic, you might be asked if you're American or not.
Yeah.
That's just something I grew up with. I didn't realize, apparently, that was microaggression and that I should be triggered by it.
Right.
So, Peter and I were having a conversation one day. I mean, he and I hung out together quite a bit. We would play golf together. We played on the softball team at the law firm. And I don't remember when it happened. But he asked me that question. Where are you from? And I was like, well, dude, you know I'm from Dallas. No, where are you really from?
Yeah.
I was like, well, I was born in Hondo. And I kind of started to realize what he was really asking me in a roundabout way. And he said, well, where are your parents from? I said, they're from Hondo, too. And Hondo's a little town in South Texas, near San Antonio. And then he said, well, what about your grandparents? I said, well, they're from Hondo as well. I was like, dude, what are you trying to ask me? I said, you trying to ask me where is my origin? I said, honestly, on my dad's side, that my family's been in Texas since before... You know, before Texas became part of the United States, you know. The famous line in the movie Selena, we didn't cross the border crossed us. That's true with my family on my dad's side.
Yeah.
And I kind of laughed it off, you know. I didn't feel offended by it. And then I asked him this question. I said, well, Peter, where are you from? He said, well, I was born in Fort Worth. I said, how about your parents? Well, my dad was born, you know, in Chicago or whatever. And my mom was born in Germany. It's like, dude, I'm more American than you are.
Yeah.
And then we laughed about it. And we wound up becoming really good friends. And ultimately, he's responsible for introducing me to my wife.
Yeah.
Now, had I taken offense to that supposed microaggression and gone off on him, we might never become friends. And I would have never met my wife.
Right.
So, the reason I share that story with my students is that, you know, I tell my kids, the race card is not on the top of the deck and it's not on the bottom of the deck. You know, have I encountered some forms of racism in my 50 plus years of living? Absolutely, I have. But I attribute that to messed up people, right. Not to a whole race of people. You know, it's like, I just feel, you know, it's so funny to me. When we have these discussions at school, I always have to preface things by saying, oh, by the way, y'all do know that I'm married to a white woman. You know?
Yeah.
You can't have these conversations. It almost feel like, you know, that part of what happens is that the whole group of people, i.e. white people, are, well, y'all are all racist.
Right.
Y'all are all slave owners. You hate all of us.
Yeah.
You want to put all of us behind a wall. And to me, that's just as bad as what white supremacists do, because I've actually heard very educated people say that minorities can't be racist. And I'm sorry, that's just not true. I've seen some of the worst racism come from people who are people of color, towards white people and towards each other.
Yeah.
Don't even get me started about the inter-ethnic discrimination that takes place. There's this whole issue, both among Hispanics and blacks, about the lighter complected you are versus darker yeah. you are. Craziness.
Yeah.
But the point of my story isn't just to talk about microaggression. It's that going back to some of the conversations we had last week and the week before about being intentional about connecting and finding commonality, I liked Peter. I judged Peter on the fact that he and I hung out together and had fun together. I didn't judge him based on what might have been an insensitive question. You know? And I had enough discernment to realize that his intent was not evil. He wasn't trying to marginalize me. He honestly thought that was an appropriate question to ask. So like, you know, are you from Mexico? What he was really asking, is your family from Mexico or Honduras or whatever? He didn't feel comfortable enough to ask that question.
Right.
You know, and it's not generally a question. Like, when I first met you, I didn't ask, well, is your family from Ireland?
Right.
Or Scotland? What type of name is Connolly? Should there be an O in front of your name?
Right, right.
So, I just think that the lesson that's learned from that is step back from the situation. If you go in with kind of this chip on your shoulder that any comment that a person makes to you is microaggression, you're going to find it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that you're not going to encounter some of that, but if your immediate reaction, and here's the next point I want to make. If you respond with anger or violence, then, and let's say, for example, Peter intended to be offensive. I've just empowered him.
Right.
I let his simple words dictate how I act.
Right. So, one of the things that I've heard in terms of microaggression, let me rephrase that. You made a comment about insensitivity versus microaggression. And inside of that is intent.
Right.
And people are not being judged on intent. They're being judged on ignorance, if you will.
Sure.
And if you're looking for a fight and somebody's insensitive and you choose to read it as aggression so that you can respond, who is the aggressor there? I mean, seriously, who's the aggressor? One of the, I guess, theories is that I should spend a great deal of time monitoring what I think and say so as to be certain not to be insensitive. Okay? Well, that's an interesting standard for me to have to deal with, and you not to have to deal with it at all, for an example. Okay? And based on this idea that, okay, you're of Mexican background or whatever, I'm European. And what am I exactly? We don't even know because my dad was adopted. So my last name is Connolly. There's apparently no Irish in the family whatsoever. Okay? So I have to be held to some sort of standard where I have to be cautious about saying, are you from Mexico? Because that might be hurtful, whether I intend it or not. But you don't have to be held to any such standard. So are you from Ireland? Potato eater? I mean, now, that's never happened to me here. It's happened to Irish people on the East Coast, you know, back in the 1800s. So my point is what is in a person's heart? And I think that if you're not willing to give people the benefit of the doubt to start with, then you're looking for a fight. And I'm sorry, if you're looking for a fight, you're the aggressor. Now, I'm not trying to say these people who are crying microaggression or aggressors too, because let's be serious about it. They don't even know what they're saying, half of them. They're repeating crap they've heard from somebody else. They've decided that they have a right to be offended. They're not looking to start a fight necessarily, but they're ready to be offended or triggered or whatever the terminology is. And what do you get out of that? To put it a different way, would you have been better off if you decided to be offended by every insensitive or thoughtless comment people made to you your whole life? Would you be a better man today? That's not a rhetorical question. I'm actually asking you. If you had responded as an aggrieved party every time somebody said something to you that could be interpreted as microaggression, and you'd responded in whatever the appropriate response to aggression is, which is defense or offense, would you be a better man today?
Well, the way I will answer that question is that it depends. And what I mean by that is this, is that as you were talking, I was like, so there's some part of me that does believe this. What gives Peter the right, or you the right, to ask me that question in the first place? Why not just assume I'm just as American as you are? Why do you need to ask me that question? So there's a hint of that there.
Sure.
So, you know, I would even argue on that some level that I've held myself to a higher standard than some of the white friends I've had.
Sure.
That I've tolerated their ignorance.
Right.
Where I'm never going to ask that question. So, no, I asked it of Peter in that context because...
You were educated.
Yes, and I made a point, and actually it turned out to be a great point because it led to laughter.
Right.
And the older I've gotten, the more I've become to realize that laughter and humor can diffuse some of the war situations.
Right.
So, I had a coworker who liked to ask questions like that I did not necessarily feel his intentions were as noble as Peter's were.
Sure.
And I'm not going to get the same benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And so I'm not going to lie to you and say that I haven't responded negatively. I don't think I've ever punched anybody.
Okay.
If I did, I don't remember.
But heat of battle.
And I don't remember ever getting into a huge argument about it. My, you know, sarcasm would have been my weapon of choice.
Sure.
To probably belittle somebody for asking that type of question, which may not be been the most charitable response. But, you know, and in the big scheme of things, it's probably not the most Christian view of it, but sometimes I don't think people deserve the charitable response. Mm. So, I don't know, that, you know, hope that didn't scandalize anybody. I'm just being real here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that, particularly living in Texas, you know, I think people in Florida, you know, somebody in Florida is not going to be accused of being a Mexican.
Right.
You know,
they're going to be accused of being Cuban.
Cuban. You know. New York is Puerto Rican.
Right.
But, and different people handle that differently, you know. But, you know, I have kids that have really embraced the notion of being called Mexican, even though they were born here in the United States. For some reason, that's always rubbed me the wrong way. Because I knew in my heart of hearts that, you know, my family's been here a very long time. I'm American, and I'm as American as you are.
Right.
But, I mean, you're right. That's a miserable life if you live your life looking for a fight every single time. And I think that looking for opportunities to educate people is a lot easier, or maybe not easier, it's a lot better.
Yeah, it is a lot better.
For everybody involved. So I think one of the real points that underlines all of this is to kind of bring it all together, I think we've kind of been all over the map, is that there is fundamentally a lack of respect for human dignity. And we talked about that when we had the social doctrine conversation, and you alluded to this, is that if as a culture we can't respect the human dignity of other people, then we're going to have these type of problems.
Right.
And it's at the root of everything, that all the problems that we have right now, whether it's these issues of race relations or issues of life, whether it's abortion or euthanasia, which is another topic that we've talked about before, it all goes back. And, you know, when we talked about the Catholic social doctrine, we said that fundamentally at its foundation is you have to have a respect for human dignity.
Yeah.
And if you don't respect the other, if you don't respect someone's dignity, you are not going to respect them as an individual, and then that's going to lead to you marginalizing them or dehumanizing them or not thinking they're human, and we're right back to where we started from.
And if you don't have a respect, if you don't respect the dignity of the human person, then you cannot feel connected to them. You cannot have solidarity. You can't work for the good of the other. You can't have empathy because of the, like, if you dehumanize somebody, you don't have empathy for that person. You know, it really starts there. It starts at the most fundamental place
that it is.
So, I don't know if you want to go here or not, but, you know, in the terms of the dignity and the respect for others and all that, I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that we have a statue of Robert E. Lee in Lee Park in the middle of Dallas. And should something be done about that?
You know, I have mixed feelings about that. You know, I have a book on my bookshelf, Leadership Qualities Learned from Robert E. Lee.
Right.
And it would be really funny. Not funny, haha, but it's funny if somebody, one of my students, would found that and questioned me about it. But from a military state, you know, I'm former military, I'm a veteran, I'm a former right. military. I have read the lives of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the military leaders. And there's more to those people than what people, you know, there's more to them than just slavery.
Right.
You read the life of Stonewall Jackson and the relationship that he had with his wife and how much he loved his wife. That's part of who that person is.
Right.
I don't know the full context of the story, and I'm getting a little bit off track, but he used to refer to his wife as his esposita. Mm. And I don't know if that's because he participated in some sort of campaign that involved, you know, like the Mexican-American War or anything like that, but it goes back to what we said before the podcast. It's more complex than just pigeonholing somebody into a category. You know, before the Civil War, Robert E. Lee was considered a great general.
Yeah.
If you look at the history, the Confederacy wound up with most of the best generals.
Yeah.
From West Point. But the other side of that is that that particular statue, not just a statue, it's a whole park
right.
dedicated to him. It was built in like the 1930s.
Right.
And so we were talking about this before the show, is that I could see the argument that you're respecting the military leadership or whatever, had it been something that had been constructed in the 1880s. Those things were built in the 1930s and 40s. There's some people who argue. I haven't done enough research, so I'm just going on what I've heard. And we had this discussion at the table with two of our young teachers who teach U.S. history. We're talking about this. And it was their opinion that since these things were put up in the 40s and 30s, there was a comment to, we may have lost the war, but we're still holding on to something. So the bigger concern I have is this, is that when you start, no pun intended, but when you start whitewashing history mm-hmm. and removing memories of what happened, people forget.
Right.
You know, I think there's a danger there that these people who are moving for this may actually, to use a debate term, be turning the argument back on themselves.
Right.
To create an environment where you're actually making it more possible for history to repeat itself.
Yeah.
Because we don't have those memories of how things used to be. I'm not saying that we need to keep, you know, like a couple of years, because it's been probably 10 years ago, they uncovered a sign when they were doing some remodeling in one of the courthouses downtown. Behind one of the water fountains was still a sign that said whites only.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I'm not advocating that that sign needed to stay up.
Yeah.
But let me tell you something. That I remember when I took a debate trip when I was in college, I was on the debate team at SMU. We went to Vanderbilt, and on the way to Vanderbilt, we stopped in Mississippi. I encountered a restroom that still said that.
Really?
It was shocking to me.
Yeah.
And it also gave me an appreciation of where we had come from then.
Sure.
This was in the early, mid-80s. So, you know, what happens to future generations if they don't have that to talk about? What's next? Do we just eliminate the discussion of them in the history books? Because the thing of it is that I think there is a movement to create caricatures of these historical figures that they're just purely evil.
Right.
And that's not the case. It's much more complex than that. And I think there's a danger there. So the short answer is, I don't know. I think that, you know, we might wake up tomorrow and find that that statue's gone, because that's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
You know, Baltimore just last night, overnight, removed their statues.
Really?
Yeah. And Robert E. Lee's probably the one that's most prominent in Dallas. There are a bunch of Confederate statues, and there is a cemetery that's right next to the Dallas Convention Center. I would be really shocked that anybody knew that those things existed.
Yeah.
You really have to look for them. So...
So, I have a couple of different thoughts that I'll try to weave together in a short period of time. I read once that probably the greatest tragedy in our nation's history was the assassination of Lincoln. And the reason that was a tragedy is because he had a plan for reintegrating the South with the North that was, in the minds of many, quote-unquote, too soft. He was trying to mend the nation and bring it back together, and the North wanted the South punished. And when he was assassinated, that sense of we need to punish the South was ascendant in 1L. And so there was the whole Reconstruction, which was apparently horrible, okay? And so... it can be argued that that's the root of a lot of the racism that grew out of the Civil War. That sense of I'm being kicked while I'm down, I'm being beat, etc., etc. I think there's a lesson there about the role of the victor. And I actually think we learned that lesson if you look at how we dealt with Japan.
But we did learn that lesson with Germany.
Well, and we didn't learn that lesson with Germany in World War I.
That's what I mean. For sure.
Yeah. And it can be argued that, hence, World War II. I feel like now, somebody who is Japanese listening to this podcast, I'd be fascinated to hear your thoughts on this. Because I'm not Japanese, and I'm not there, and I wasn't alive during that period of time. So I am sincerely asking, correct me if I'm wrong. But my point is... today, Japan, to all appearances, is an ally, and we're not having the kind of relationship with Japan that the North has had with the South, and whites have had with blacks, etc. here. So, I think the erection of the statue of all these Confederate generals is a kind of a middle finger to the North. I don't think it's a middle finger to black people, but maybe so, because you got to find somebody to kick. And you can't really kick the North, but your black neighbor you can. So, to some degree, I feel like that there's a negativity associated with that because of the ground from which it grew. I commented earlier before the podcast about that kind of skit that I heard on the radio where a cross-character, ultra-conservative, you would think white makes right kind of a person commented that it's customary for the side that loses the war to take down their flag. And so there's a piece of me that really doesn't have a problem with the idea of the Confederate flag going away. There is no Confederacy. They lost the war. What is the purpose of having a Confederate flag? I think it's disingenuous for people to go, well, we're remembering history and all that crap.
I agree.
I think that's wrong. I think that is a middle finger to whoever it is that they feel like they need to shoot the middle finger to. So having the Confederate flags removed, I don't really have a problem with that. The fact that Walmart won't sell them anymore, that's fine with me. I don't care. They don't exist. It's like having the Confederate flag of Istanbulia, a non-existent place, you know? The thing that makes me sad about Robert E. Lee is that, by all accounts, he was a good man. an extremely accomplished general, very concerned about his soldiers. He was asked to lead the army, and he did it. Was he wrong? I don't know. We'd had slavery. You know, everybody, the other thing everybody wants to say, the Civil War was about abolishing slavery. Was it? I've heard people say it was about states' rights. But the little bit of research I've done is it was about states' rights to own slaves. Mm-hmm. So however you want to color it, it's about slavery at some level. It's also about autonomy and things like that. It's also a fact that the economy of the South was absolutely dependent upon slavery. It's also a fact that in about 30 more years, that was going to end because of the cotton gin. Slavery was going to go away because slaves are more expensive than cotton gins. So it was going to become economically infeasible to maintain, you know, 50, 60 slaves on your plantation. So it was going away at some point. The whole thing is a tragedy. And I think the biggest tragedy to it is that we can't have serious conversations rationally in charity and sort out what we should do.
Right.
To me, right now, today, in my, you know, coming here from California, the first time I saw a Confederate flag, I was shocked. Because there are no Confederate flags. At the time that I lived in California, there were no Confederate flags anywhere. Nor were there monuments to Civil War heroes. So I was surprised when I figured out Lee Park was about Robert E. Lee. Because I was, the first place I was going, how involved was Texas in the Civil War anyway? Not that involved. So why do we have a Robert E. Lee statue? He wasn't Texan. I can understand, you know, Houston and even Davy Crockett, you know, who wasn't born here, but he died here, you know. But there's a piece of me that feels sad that the goodness of Robert E. Lee is, people want to remove it because of his decision to fight for the South. Was it a wrong decision? I mean, he didn't think so at the time. Is it hurtful to people now? I question how hurtful it really is. You know, do people look at that statue and feel oppressed? Oppressed by Robert E. Lee? I mean, what is really going on here? So I find some of this focus disingenuous. It's like what we were saying earlier. It's just a way to look for something to argue about. It's a pawn. Robert E. Lee today is not a knight or a bishop or a rook. He's a pawn in a different war that's going on. And there's a kind of a violence associated with that as well. Should it be there? Shouldn't it not be there? You know, I think it's open for conversation. We should be able to have a rational conversation about that. And we should look towards healing and making things better. But again, I just question, are people really triggered by Robert E. Lee's statue in Lee Park in Dallas? Can I even say, as a white man, do I have the right
to say that? Well, there'd be people that say you don't have the right to say that.
Yeah.
So, I'm not one of them, but be that as it may. Well, we're obviously not going to solve the problem.
No.
Talking about it tonight, but I still go back to that. If we can't have rational, charitable discussions with people who have differing views, and I keep hearing myself say that here, is that that seems to be a problem in our society.
Yeah.
We can't have discussions with people we disagree with and talk things through. It just turns into a shouting match or a name calling.
We need to raise the level of debate from the grade school playground to adult.
And that's got to happen with the common people.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen with the politicians.
No, I don't know why we're looking for Trump to lead us down some moral rightness.
Yeah, I'm not looking for any politician to lead us that
way. No.
All right. So, you know, part of our podcast is smoking cigars.
Yep.
It's interesting to me that we don't have a lot of cigars from America that we talk about. Southern tobacco and whatnot.
Yeah, anyway, and we're overly concerned about where did this cigar come from?
Any final thoughts about your cigar?
I like it. I will buy more of these. This is a very good cigar. Getting hints of smoke. Okay, I can tell you what I... So I'll have a negative review, okay?
All right.
No maraschino cherry. No saddle leather. No pepper, and I've had that before. I will say there's one word that's kind of coming to me, and it's creamy.
Okay.
So I will say creamy.
All right. So mine was spicy, peppery, woody. I did not pick up any of the sweetness. That may be, that's normally associated with the Cameroon. It may be in a delayed reaction later on. Sometimes that happens. Good cigar, smoked all the way through. It was a little, burned a little hot at the end, but not unbearable. I would smoke it again.
I'll say this. This is, a lot of times I'm having to relight a cigar or even it out. I haven't had to do that with this one. It's, I did drop an ash all over myself.
You did.
I didn't even notice. That's how pleased I was. So, good cigar.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed tonight's show. And if you don't get anything out of tonight, that in the spirit of some of our past podcasts, that you find opportunities and leisure to sit together and have rational discussions with people. Don't just spend time with people that you agree with. It's okay to disagree. You know, Mark and I don't always agree on everything. And I think that's the beauty of the friendship. And sometimes we change each other's views. You changed my view on relighting the cigar.
Yeah.
And I was pretty dogmatic about that. So there can be change from
life altering.
So when you have these discussions, smoke them if you got them.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.